This is Radio Sai Answering Booth, a show of questions and answers. Questions yours and answers mine. Called out from Swami's message, of course. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, possibly the one who benefits most through this program, for which I'm immensely grateful to the Swami in each one of you. Last week I played a talk and did not take on a question, but this week I have a few questions lined up, probably to make up. A listener had sent us a few questions, and like all questions I've received on the show, they are relevant and I believe will give us an opportunity to explore certain aspects of Swami's message. I'm hoping we'll be able to deal with at least two of them today, but we'll see how it goes. But we will get to the questions when we have to. For now, let us begin the show as always by offering our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet. Let me then take you through the interesting quote that I intend to share with all of you today. The quote is that of an Australian entrepreneur and TV personality, Tabata Coffee, and I quote, "We have to stand up for what we believe in, even when we might not be popular for it. Honesty starts with being ourselves, authentic and true to who we are and what we believe in, and that may not always be popular, but it will always let you follow your dreams and your heart." End of quote. When we say that we believe in something, a philosophy of life, a certain approach to life, it means that we are ready to stand by it. What is the point if I say I believe in something but don't align my life in accordance to it? It can only mean that I actually don't believe in it, but say so because it's probably the right thing to say. This may appear inane to most of us. How can I believe in one thing and not live my life in accordance to that? But if we truly analyze our belief systems and how we respond to situations in day-to-day life, we will notice that there is a definite gap in it. Swami would always give the example of our fear of fire. The idea or belief that fire will hurt us is so strongly ingrained in our system that it will be uppermost in our mind when we are dealing with fire of any sort. But Swami would say that it is not the same with our other belief systems. Swami would tell a very funny little chinakatha. A man is introduced to the concept of Advaita by a master and given the mantra Shivoham. Swami says that he goes about loudly proclaiming this idea, Shivoham, Shivoham. So one of his friends accosts him and asks him, "What are you shouting this Shivoham, Shivoham, and what does that phrase mean actually?" The man proudly says, "It means that I am Shiva. This is the revelation my guru has given me." The friend very innocently asks him, "So you really believe that you are Lord Shiva?" The man replies, "Of course, my guru has said it and I believe it." Then the friend asks him, "If you are Lord Shiva, who is Mother Parvati to you?" And immediately that man says, "Oh, what a mistake I have done, what a blasphemy," and starts slapping his cheeks in repentance. Swami goes on to say, that is how our belief systems are. Why can't that man say with confidence, "Yes, Mother Parvati is also within me, as she is a part of Lord Shiva"? The quote that I read is probably said in a very different context, so more worldly ideas and belief systems based on what the quote was actually made. But consider the concept of faith itself. When we say, "I have faith in Swami, I have faith in God," what does it really mean? I'm sure most of us claim that we believe in Swami, isn't it? What does it really mean? I don't think I will be able to comprehensively define that in a few lines, but putting it simply, when we say I believe in Swami or have faith in Swami's divinity, we acknowledge that that He knows better than we. No situation is beyond His control. He is always just, and so whatever He does is always right. So this one belief should make us absolutely fearless, isn't it? We must be able to do what is right and have the courage to do it come what may. We may be laughed at, we may be mocked at, we may end up on the losing side, things may go from bad to worse, but we must be able to stand up to that faith and say, "No, Swami knows best, I will still fearlessly do what Swami expects of me and leave the rest to Him." But this is unfortunately not the case. Well, I can speak at least for myself, I do lack that fearlessness sometimes, I see that in myself. So we claim to believe in many things, but there are very few things we actually believe in. I know the quote must have been made in a completely different context, as I said, but in spirituality, it takes an even deeper meaning. Because we constantly read and gather knowledge about many, many concepts. How many of those concepts we are ready to truly live by? This is a question we must ask ourselves constantly. And those concepts alone that we are ready to live by can define us. Others, as Swami would say, are merely bookish knowledge. So before we move on, dear listeners, permit me to read out that quote by Tabata Coffey one more time. I quote, "We have to stand up for what we believe in, even when we might not be popular for it. Honesty starts with being ourselves, authentic and true to who we are and what we believe in. And that may not always be popular, but it will always let you follow your dream and your heart." Well, let's then head to the questions. As I said, one of our listeners, who of course wishes to be anonymous, has sent us a couple of questions. Actually, I think she sent about 3 or 4 questions. One of those questions were very similar to a question that we handled a couple of weeks ago. But there are 3 questions, so I thought we will try as much as possible to accommodate at least 2 questions on the show. But let's see how it goes. I have the 2 questions in the voice of the listener who sent it to us. I'll play the first question and I'll answer it, and then I think we'll go to the second question after that. So this is the first question that she has sent us.
Sai Ram Prem Bhaiya, my hearty thanks to you and Radio Sai team. I just love your show. My question is, we all know that the food we take should be pure as they affect our thoughts, which ultimately affect our character. But sometimes it's impossible to make sure that the food is completely pure. And our beloved Lord has given us the simplest way to purify it. All we have to do is just do the food prayer before eating. My question is, what do we do in situations when people serve you something in the middle of your meal? Example, in weddings, restaurants, or family meetings, the food keeps on coming while you're eating. I can't be doing food prayer every time one item is being put on my plate, right? So what can I do? Please guide. Thank you, Sai Ram.
Well, that's the first question. It's an interesting question, actually a cute question, I should say. But there's a fundamental thinking behind that question itself. It's a process that most of us tend to do, which I'll probably try to touch upon. If anyone was not able to follow the question was about the food prayer that we often do, and Swami says that we do the food prayer, which we popularly refer to as Brahmarpanam. One of the reasons that Swami makes us do that is Swami says that it purifies the food. You make the food an offering to God, and that purifies the food, and what you consume becomes Swami's prasadam. Swami would say in that context that the food that we consume becomes a part of our thinking, and so the purity or the to pay attention to the purity of the food is very, very important. And Swami would talk of purity as being threefold. Swami would say Pak Shuddhi, Padartha Shuddhi, and Patra Shuddhi. Pak Shuddhi meaning purity of the one who is cooking the food. Padartha Shuddhi is purity of the ingredients being used to cook the food. And Patra Shuddhi refers to the purity of the vessels or the containers that are used to prepare and serve the food. But all this we must try to follow as much as we can. Swami would say that it's very difficult to ensure that all of this is maintained in the food that we eat, and that's why it's very important to chant the Brahmarpanam prayer. It purifies the food. But that does not make that does not mean that we should not try to ensure these 3 kinds of purity in the food. We must try as much as possible to follow or ensure that the food is pure in these 3 ways that I just mentioned. Because one thing is that when we try to do that, when we try to ensure Pak Shuddhi, Padartha Shuddhi, and Patra Shuddhi, as Swami says it, it ensures that not only does it ensure that our intake is pure, it also makes a lot of other things fall in place in our life. It automatically regulates our life in multiple ways. And that's why it's very important to try as much as possible to ensure Pakshuddhi, Patarth Shuddhi and Patra Shuddhi. I'll explain that a little further before we actually start answering the question as to how many times that you have to chant Brahmarpanam. I'll explain what the question was and I missed that. The person was asking that we need, Swami has said that we should chant Brahmarpanam before we consume our food. So is it enough if we chant the Brahmarpanam prayer before we start our food? What happens when people serve us in between a meal, you know, either in a restaurant or when we go for a wedding, when the meal is not completely placed on your plate, like it happens in our hostels, you know, there's always line serving, or you go up to a counter and take more food. So does that mean that every time food is served on your plate, you chant the Brahmarpanam mantra again? So is that how we have to do, or is it enough if I do the chanting once? So that was a question. So as I said, the three purities which Swami refers to are not only physical in nature, but it is also a little more subtle than that, and Swami himself explains it. For instance, when you refer to Padartha Shuddhi or the purity of ingredients, Swami would say it's not only about the stuff that goes into the food being pure. One way is that he rules out some kinds of food like which are tamasic, non-vegetarian food, for instance, Swami is absolutely against. Intoxicants, consumption of intoxicants is something which Swami does not approve of. So these two things are considered, I mean, some of the food items like this are considered impure. Swami says that they should not be a part of your food. And then Swami says that food that is acquired through unrighteous means becomes impure, right? That's why it becomes more subtle. It's not just purity of the ingredients, but purity of how the ingredients are acquired also become a part of the purity of the ingredients. So Swami says that food should not be acquired through unrighteous means. Similarly, when Swami refers to Pakshuddhi or Padartha Shuddhi, Pakshuddhi or Patra Shuddhi, you know, the vessel in which it is being cooked or the cook who is cooking the dish for you, Swami would say that even they should be pure, and it does not again mean only physical purity. Swami extends the idea and says the person cooking should have good thoughts while cooking the food, right? So when we try to observe some of these things, we automatically understand that probably food cooked at home is in many ways better than eating out unnecessarily, right? And we all, youngsters, I think, tend to underestimate the value of food cooked at home by our mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters or whatever it is. Because when they cook for us, you know, automatically they do it out of an intention of love. And Swami would say that much of the vibrations of the food are purified when a mother cooks or the father cooks, thinking that this is for the children and I do it out of love. So we must try as much as possible to observe these things. When I say that the food that I eat or the food that I serve to my children have to be pure, so I have to acquire it in the right means, automatically you start leading a righteous life, right? So when the mother is cooking, if she says that I need to have good thoughts when I'm cooking the food, automatically, you know, that regulates her thinking and the way she, approaches that duty of hers, right? So this is why I'm saying that it is not that Brahmarpanam is going to negate the need for trying to ensure these three forms of purity in the food that we consume. Swami says that we must ensure that the purest food in all these ways, but it is not always practically possible to ensure it to the absolute extent, right? For instance, in the past, I think ingredients used to be grown in the same village, or people would grow vegetables and fruits in their own gardens. But now I think most of our ingredients come through the market. There's a supply chain. We have no idea where it comes from and what are the different, who are the different people who handle that ingredient before it reaches us, right? So it's not possible for us to ensure that all the time. And some of us are forced to eat out. Not all of us have the luxury of being able to be eating at home. I mean, and our work takes us to different places, right? So Swami says that try as much as possible as you can to follow this instruction of eating pure food through these three points that I mentioned. What is beyond you, what you cannot take care with your immediate actions, Swami says that will be taken care of by this food prayer that we chant, which is the Brahmarpanam prayer. Therefore, it is not that I can eat anything and any quantity and do all sorts of things to earn the way I earn my living, and that goes into my food, and then I chant Brahmarpitam and say I'm good. Right? At least I don't think it works that way. We need to be fair with how much ever we can. As much as we can, we must ensure that the food that we consume is pure in these forms. Of course, it's absolutely not fair on my part to put a cap on Swami's grace and say that it will not work on these conditions. If you offer your food after doing these things, Swami will not accept it. I don't think I have the authority to say that, but it appears that Swami does want us to follow a little bit what he refers to as these threefold forms of purity of food. But what is beyond us, what we cannot ensure through our actions and through, you know, our immediate choices and decisions, Swami says chanting Brahmarpanam will take care of it. It'll make the food that we consume Swami's prasadam, and Swami's prasadam is always pure. But this alone is not the role of the food prayer, because that is a very important aspect of the food prayer, and I think that will also answer the question that has been asked as to how many times you have to chant, how often it has to be chanted, is it enough to chant once before the meal or multiple times. And there's another reason why a concept such as a food prayer is introduced into our lives and our schedules. I'll come to that in a bit. Now I'll talk about why such a question occurs to us at all. This question of, is it enough if I chant the Brahmarpanam once, or should I chant it every time I take a morsel into my mouth? Or how many times to chant? What to chant? Is it enough if I chant only Brahmarpanam? I think sometime back we had a mail from one of our listeners who said, should I chant Brahmarpanam and the Aham Vaishvanaro Bhutva mantras alone? I also chant the Gayatri mantra. So am I supposed to chant the Gayatri mantra before I do the Brahmarpanam, or should I do it after I do the Brahmarpanam? Should I chant the regular Gayatri mantra? Is it okay if I chant the Sai Gayatri mantra? Right? Some of these questions occur to us. Why do we have such questions when we are referring to prayer? Right? I'm not trying to say that these are silly questions to raise. There is a reason why we think this way. There's a reason why such questions and such doubts actually occur to us, and I want to talk about that briefly for the next few minutes. The moment we say that such and such a prayer is meant to achieve such and such outcome, I think our mind automatically asks which is the right way of doing it. We start treating prayer as a specific result-oriented action, right? So the moment we do that, the moment we start thinking of prayer as being done to achieve a certain outcome, I think we tend to think, what is the most effective modus operandi of doing this, right? Like a medicine that we take, or an exercise regime that we want to take on. You know, should I take the medicine before I have the meal, or after I have the meal? Can I take it along with the other medication that I'm taking? Or if you're going to start a new exercise regime, you know, how many reps should I do that? Should I do this early in the morning, or is it okay if I do it in the evening? Because when we look at a certain activity as being performed to achieve a certain result, we know that it has to be done in a certain manner. There is a modus operandi that goes with that action, right? So this is very common, and we do this for all other activities that we, undertake in our life. And when we take up prayer, especially the Brahmarpanam prayer, when we say that it is chanted so that the food gets purified, automatically our mind starts thinking, so what is the best way of doing it, right? This is very common. It happens with all of us. I'm saying this because I have observed myself doing this many, many times. But when it comes to prayer, unlike the other activities that we do, unlike the medicine that we take or some of the disciplines that we wish to take on in our life, when it comes to prayer, the only thing that perfects prayer, the only thing that perfects the method, is not the method itself. It's not the methodology of the prayer itself, but the feeling with which it is done, right? That's what we many times come across, and Swami himself has made it very, very clear. What makes a prayer work is not necessarily the perfection of the intonation or the perfection of the way it is, the way it is sung or anything like that. But Swami says it's the feeling with which it is being offered. So a prayer becomes perfect not by how diligently it is being said or how perfectly it is being said, but with what feeling it is being said, right? So the very fact that the quantity or the process does not matter is expressed in, you know, how this Brahmarpanam prayer was instituted in our hostels. There's a very interesting story of how the Brahmarpanam prayer came by. You know, some of our lecturers would tell us about many of these schedules in the hostel, how they were all brought about in a very democratic process, where Swami would discuss with the students and Swami would say, you know, you have to wake up at this time. And the students would say, Swami, that's too early. You know, can we get up a little later? And Swami would say, okay, not later than this. And then Swami would say, we should have jogging. You know, let's do this at this time. So it was all arranged and it was all arrived upon in such manner. So when it comes to this Brahmarpanam prayer, one of my lecturers was telling us that earlier when this practice of chanting Brahmarpanam before a meal started in the hostel, they would chant the Brahmarpanam mantra, which was preceded, of course, by three ohms. And then there would be the Aham Vaishvanaro Bhutva mantra. And then they would chant the Sai Gayatri mantra. And then they would have Loka Samasta three times. And then Shanti Shanti three times. Now, this is how the initial food prayer was. And those days, Swami would come very regularly to the hostel for dining sessions with the students, at least a few times in a semester, I guess. And on one such day, Swami observed that this particular sequence of the food prayer was taking way too long. And Swami said, hey, this is taking too much time and your food is getting cold in your plate. So then Swami said quickly, you know, you drop the Sai Gayatri mantra, you know, no need three ohms, start with one ohm. I don't know what was the modification that Swami made. But Swami made the food mantra very concise for the very fact that the food on the plate is getting cold, you know, with this extended chanting of the food prayer. Right. I'm saying this because I feel that's because the process does not matter. What matters is the feeling with which it is done. Diligence in prayer is worthy only when it is an expression of that bhavam or the feeling. If you strongly feel that Swami likes it this way, so I'll get the pronunciation perfect, I'll tell it slowly and I'll tell it as clearly as I can, then it just becomes an expression of your sincerity, right? It's the diligence that you show in that prayer just is an expression of the bhavam with which you want to utter that prayer. So when it comes to prayer, diligence by itself means very little. Only when it is an expression of the feeling, it has any value, right? Talking about the food prayer before I go on to the other point that I want to make, there's a very beautiful incident that I happened to read a long time ago. I don't recall where exactly I read it, and I don't recall the name of the student who was involved in this incident, but I read it, I think, in one of the publications of Swami, where I think it was during the summer courses when Swami would come to the hostel for the dining sessions. Even till when we were students, the first dining session of the summer course would always have Swami coming to the hostel and dining with the students. And again, for the last dining session also, Swami would come. So it was one particular dining session like that. The students were all seated. They were all chanting the Brahmarpanam mantra. In those days, there used to always be a few school students also participating in the summer course. Not officially, but they would stay back during the vacation. Swami would permit them also to be a part of the summer course. So there was this one little primary school boy who was sitting there with his food, and the Brahmarpanam was being chanted, and Swami was sitting on his table waiting for the students to finish the Brahmarpanam so he could also join them in the meal. When suddenly it occurred to this little boy that we always chant the Brahmarpanam and we imagine that we are offering the food to Swami, but here is Swami sitting physically in front of us. Why not I offer the food physically to Swami? So even as the Brahmarpanam was being chanted, what this boy did, he picked up his plate. Apparently he walked up to Swami and he physically offered that food to Swami, right? It was a very sweet sight of this little boy offering his food to Swami. So don't ask me which year was it. I don't know any of those details. But the incident is very beautiful and profound for what Swami did after that. And since this boy was offering the food to Swami, Swami stretched out his hand and actually picked out a piece of the food, a morsel of the food from this boy's plate. But when everybody noticed what actually Swami picked out, I think they had served a particular variety of vada that day. And Swami stretched his hand and picked out the chili which was sticking out of the vada, right? And Swami showed that chili to the people around and Swami said, see, this is what God does when you offer your food to God, when you perform the Brahmarpanam. Swami said that I will take that which is not suitable for you, and I will give you that which is more palatable to you. Right? So it was a practical demonstration of Brahmarpanam and what is the role that Swami plays when you do Brahmarpanam, right? So, I mean, these are the ways in which Swami teaches us. So it was not that Swami didn't say that all of you had to come walking with your plates and offering it to me and I will pull out the chilies from your plates. Swami didn't say that. It was a very categorical gesture. It was a very symbolic gesture. So similarly, just like how that boy offering that plate physically was symbolic and Swami picking out the chili was symbolic, similarly, I think the prayer itself is a form of symbolism where you're saying that I'm offering this food to Swami, and we believe that when we offer, Swami accepts it and purifies it. So Swami will accept it if you say the prayer once, twice. Even if you can't say the prayer itself, if you just close your eyes and say, Swami, please accept this food and as my offering, I think that is enough. You don't even have to learn the mantra in Sanskrit and say it. Because it's all about the attitude, and it's all about the prayer itself is only a symbolism of that attitude of offering. Going back to what I was speaking a couple of weeks back in response to a question that we had, it was a very interesting question about, you know, what is bhavam, what is feeling, and how do you develop feeling, right? And I'd mentioned there that bhavam becomes truly perfect. The feeling with which we make any offering becomes truly perfect when we do that offering or that prayer without any expectations whatsoever. In other words, the act itself gives me what I want and I don't seek anything further beyond that act. When we pray to Swami not seeking anything, but just because thinking of Swami makes me happy, we came to the conclusion that is when actually bhavam is perfect, right? And also going back to what I said in the beginning about Brahmarpanam, that it is not only about purifying the food. You don't chant Brahmarpanam because it purifies the food. That is one of the aspects that Swami speaks about. There's more to it, right? The whole idea is that we should be able to think more of Swami. We should be able to spend more time in thoughts of God, right? That's the whole idea in the path of devotion itself. So we look for opportunities when we can think of Swami. When we wake up, when we go to bed, before we leave home for our work, before we start our work, before we eat our food. These are all opportunities that we create for ourselves so that we can do some prayer and we can think of God. Right? So that is again one of the more important roles of the Brahmarpanam prayer, or the larger role of any form of prayer. Right? Yes, for instance, we have this practice of praying to Lord Ganesha before we start something, because we believe that Ganesha is the Lord of obstacles. He removes obstacles from our path, right? Yes, that role is satisfied by a prayer to Lord Ganesha, but a larger role that any prayer, including the prayer to Ganesha, forms is, creates for us is, it's an opportunity for us to spend some moments in thoughts of God, right? So if you wish to chant before you start every course, or every time you put a morsel of food in your mouth, well, I would say, why not? But don't wonder if it will work better in the aspects of purifying the food if I do it this way. Right? That's the point I'm making. The moment we look at prayer as a result-oriented action, that is when this confusion of which is the best way to perform this prayer comes to our mind. Right? That's how we perform rituals. That's how the yajnas used to be performed in the past, where it was very important to perform the yajna so diligently, right? But when you look at prayer as a prayer should be looked at, the only way a prayer becomes perfect is through the feeling with which you do it. And if this feeling that, you know, I should be able to think of Swami as much as possible, so if you wish to, you know, say Brahmarpanam or Saishwararpanam for every morsel of food that you take, well, it would be really good. I mean, that much more time you will be spending thinking of Swami. But as I said, don't wonder if doing this will purify my food more than just chanting Brahmarpanam, you know, one time for that matter. You know, because Swami says the goal is to make everything an expression of love for God, right? So let us say that you are cooking for your family. When you think that you're cooking for Swami, right? Just like how before we eating, we say that this is an offering to God. When you cook, if you think that I am actually cooking for the Swami in the family that I'm cooking for, automatically I think you will ensure that there is purity in the ingredients, in the vessels, and you will ensure that you cook with the right kind of thoughts. Right? And during the cooking, you may not constantly think of Swami, but the act itself becomes a worship because you have started off the process by thinking that I'm going to cook for Swami, right? Same way, once you think of Swami and say, I offer this to you, I think Swami will accept it. Then, when we're eating the food, we will try not to waste that food. You know, I've seen some of the people in the hostel saying this, some of my friends and classmates. They would say that I really don't like this dish, but what do? I've chanted Brahmarpanam, now this has become prasadam, I have to eat it, right? So all of these become expression of the belief that I've offered the food to Swami and Swami has accepted it, and today, and what is here is prasadam. It's not necessary that I should constantly think of Swami. If I can, that would be the best thing, because that's the ultimate goal that we're looking for. But all of these small things start becoming expressions of this feeling, right? So I feel that if you chant once, I'm sure Swami will accept it. Even if he forget to chant it, at the end of the day, you just say that Swami, I offer all that I've consumed, all that I've had to drink and eat, I offer it to you. I don't think Swami will say that, no, you didn't tell it before you ate the food, so I will not accept it. I think Swami will accept it because if it is said with the right bhavam and the feeling, right? But if you say that I want to chant more often because I can think of Swami more often, why not? I think it's a very, very beautiful thought. In fact, I would suggest that that's a beautiful thing, that every time before we put anything in your mouth, it could be a piece of chocolate, it could be a sip of water, it could be a cup of coffee. If every time, you don't have to chant the Brahmarpanam mantra completely, but you just think of Swami and say, Swami, I offer this to you. Right? It would be a very beautiful way by which we ensure that in as many intervals of time as possible during the day, we tend to think of Swami, right? That's something that we all can assume in our day-to-day life, and I think it would really help us. Now, before I wind up this particular answer, apart from what I mentioned as the two purposes of food prayer, as Swami has said himself, where one is it purifies the food and the other is it helps us think of Swami, there is another point that Swami mentions about food prayer. I'm just mentioning it so that it completes it. At some point in our practice of the food prayer or the practice of this particular thing, Swami says that we will think sincerely as to what is the meaning of this action that I'm performing. I am offering to Swami. I am sitting with my food. I'm saying that I'm offering this to Swami. And eventually I end up eating it, right? And at some point we will stop and think, what is the meaning of this action? It can only mean that, as Swami says, that this body is nothing but a temple of God, and Swami who's sitting inside is actually accepting the offering and consuming the food, right? And that's what is the meaning of the prayer itself. The one who is offering is God. That which is being offered is God. That which will be attained in the process of this offering is also God, right? And Swami would so very beautifully explain in his discourses. Swami would say in his typical Telugu, he would say that when you say Brahmarpanam, Swami would say Javabustundi. From inside the answer comes. And what is the answer? Swami would say, Aham Vaishwanaro Bhutva Praninam Dehamashritaha Prana Pana Samayuktaha Pachamyannam Chaturvidam. Right? Swami would say, as the Vaishwanara or the digesting fire, it is I who reside in all creatures. I balance the vital layers of prana and apana, and it is I who digest the four types of food, right? So this is a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. Swami would say that this is the answer which is coming from the divinity within, right? So Swami says that some point we will stop and delve into this deep meaning of this simple act of doing a Brahmarpan before we eat our food, right? And it will strike us. It will strike us like a bolt that this body is after all a temple, and it is Swami who resides within me and within all these bodies that I see, right? Now we know it. It's an academic knowledge right now, like the quote I started with. It's a knowledge that we have. We know that Swami resides in everybody. We have that piece of information in our mind, but there will come a time when the enormity of this idea will hit us so hard that we cannot take it out of the equation of the decisions that we make and the way we interact with people around, right? So the summum bonum of, the summary of whatever I said. So how many times do we chant the Brahmarpana mantra? I think it's completely up to you, because the fact that chanting Brahmarpanam purifies our food is only one small aspect of the Brahmarpanam mantra itself. If you just say, Swami, I offer it to you, and ensure that you tell it with the true feeling, and everything else that you do after that, if you say that I will not waste food, I will not deride the food that is in front of me, I think all of that becomes a part of this idea of offering it to God. And Swami, in fact, in one of the discourses, Swami said that when you say that I'm offering this food to God, Swami says, the energy that you receive through the food that you eat is also a prasadam of God, and you ensure that you use the energy for the right activities, right? Swami says that also becomes part of your prayer. So it is about how we express this feeling of my offering to Swami, right? That is more important than how many times we say that, how long we say that, or are we saying it in the form of these Sanskrit verses, or am I saying it in English? I think that really does not matter. I'm not trying to trivialize the question that is being asked. I'm saying that this is a question these kind of questions occur to us because we tend to look at prayer as a result-oriented action, just like the many actions that we do in our life. That's how the mind works, because the mind is always trying to get maximum benefit of whatever we do, right? That's how the mind works. And we have to understand that, and we should look at some of these activities, especially like prayer, devotion, and see that this is different, right? When Swami would say quantity, quality, it differentiates the other things that we do, right? So when we realize that, we will work on the quality rather than the quantity. We will work on the intention and the feeling rather than the perfection of the act itself, right? The perfection of the act can be an expression of the feeling, but in itself, the diligence actually has no value. So that's the answer I thought I'll give to this question of, should we chant Brahmarpanam every time food is served to us or before every course? I think we'll go to the next question. We do have time for that. I'll play out the next question. It's from the same listener, but it's a little different question. Nonetheless, it's a very important one. We'll listen to the question in the voice of the listener, and we'll see what answer we can come up for that.
Our beloved Lord has so many times said that we should always keep good company, as we tend to become like our company. And by His grace, I've got all wonderful people around me. Now the very normal thing is that, though we are all doing only good, we do have different, or sometimes opposite beliefs, likes and habits. And many times I find myself thinking or behaving like others. And believe me, it can be very disturbing. But the question of avoiding them does not even arise. For if I do so, I have to go and live in a forest, as these people are extremely good, the best I've ever met. The only thing is, I want to remain myself, to be myself, and not to behave like others. I don't know if Swami has talked about it. If yes, please share. Thank you. Sai Ram.
So that's the next question. And again, it's a very interesting question. If you're not we're not able to follow what the question was. It's about, we say that we should keep good company because we tend to become like the company that we keep. And the listener was asking that some of the friends that she has are very good, but being with them, sometimes she starts thinking like them, which is not necessarily the way that Swami's philosophy is, Swami's message is, right? So how do you handle such a situation where the friends that you keep are good friends, but you don't really want to start thinking like them, right? I've handled many questions on the concept of the company, and in fact, even recently, I think I've explained about how our duty makes the company of some inevitable. In those situations, it's not about avoiding the company, but keeping that company as as much as it's necessary, because if we are duty bound to keep that company, we should not try and avoid that. And where we have a choice is where we practice this avoiding bad company, and those are the cases where we are not duty bound to keep that person's company. I'd also explain that we are not meant to always run from those who we disagree with. It's a mix of we exercising a choice to avoid such company that takes us away from Swami, and when our duty doesn't permit us that luxury, or we have to deal with that person to a certain extent, that becomes an opportunity for us in a sense to learn to be ourselves in the presence of such people who probably we do not agree with completely. Right? But this question is slightly different as I see it. And of course, I'm saying this on the basis of the explanation the listener gave me over the mail too that she had sent. There are some times that we spend time with people who are essentially good, right? I think most of the time we come across people who are essentially good. They don't come across as bad people per se, but they may have different philosophical or even religious ideas and beliefs, right? So among our friends, they may be the best that we have. Among the friends that we have, they may be the best. But when we start spending time with them, we start thinking like them. We start, believing in what they believe in. And sometimes we find that it is actually contrary to what we have learned from Swami, right? Again, this is not something which is uncommon. It happens to a lot of us. I myself seen this happening to me, and because that's how company works. When you're in the company of people, you tend to think like them, you tend to behave like them. That's why Swami says, tell me your company, I shall tell you what you are, right? Let me probably give you an example, which I think a lot of people who are in the path of spirituality, who are exploring different ideas, tend to go through. When we start reading, say, some literature of Vedantic nature or on pure Advaita for that matter, it starts to really appeal to the intellect, right? That's what Vedanta is. It is very, very intellectually stimulating, right? But this is such that it completely negates the idea of God. If you read Shuddha Advaita or very, very deep Vedantic literature, you'll find that it almost does not mention the presence of the idea of God or a personality of divinity, right? It kind of negates the idea. But the whole concept is so appealing and logical that after some time it kind of grips you and even unsettles you in relation to how you approach Swami or how you approach your other devotional activities, right? So similarly, when we come under the influence of certain friends and, say, acquaintances who are basically good people, we tend to start thinking like them, accepting their philosophy, which is not always wrong, because that's how, understanding expands. We cannot undergo all the experiences of life ourselves, so we interact with people and make their experience and knowledge a part of our understanding, right? That's how understanding expands too. But every now and then, it's very important for us to stop and analyze with our own understanding and experience, right? We have to reflect within and say, this is what is my understanding, this is what is my experience. That reflection is very, very important. Like in the case of Advaita that I was telling about, because a lot of my friends have undergone this phase and I myself been a witness to it to a little extent. So when you start getting drawn by such literature, you'll suddenly be able to not relate to Swami completely. So I think I've every now and then you'll have to stop and say that, all right, some very intelligent person, maybe a sage or a saint, has written all this, and this is his insight. This has come from his experience. But what is my experience? My experience is, I have seen Swami, I have lived with Swami, I'm living with Swami. So this idea of God being a personality is a real experience for me, right? So when I ground myself based on my own understanding and experiences that I have had, I will be more grounded and I will be able to look at this new wisdom that I'm reading or trying to acquire, and it will enrich my understanding rather than unsettling my understanding, which is already there, right? And this is something I I like to call it recalibration of our thinking, recalibration, which is a very, very important process. Those of you who are familiar with the practicals that we do in the science laboratories, you will know that recalibration is a very, very important part of practical science. For instance, in our chemistry lab, we used to have an equipment which is called an analytical balance or a physical balance, right? It is used for measuring very, very precise quantities of chemicals. And as chemists, it's a very, very important thing to be able to measure precise quantities of chemicals when you want to make solutions or solvents, right? So this was a physical balance, and this was before the digital balances came. Now you have digital balances which are accurate to the second or third decimal. Earlier we used to use this balance, and this balance is as expected. It is used to weigh substances, but the interesting thing is using it for the purpose it is meant for, that is weighing substances, eventually it loses its accuracy and precision. So every now and then what we have to do is we have to recalibrate this analytical balance or the physical balance before using it. And that's how you can ensure that you are able to measure the right substance out, right? So for this, we would have something which is called standard weights of different types. And we would use these standard weights and ensure that the balance is recalibrated before we use it for further experimentation, right? So similarly, even in our mind, in the process of using the mind itself for what it is meant for what it is righteously meant for, sometimes it does lose its balance now and then. It does happen, right? And it has to be recalibrated, and it has to be recalibrated with reference to something that is more absolute, right? This is a process that we all must do with regards to our thinking. And that absolute reference for us is, needless to say, Swami, right? And I would say the absolute reference for us is Swami accessed through our own conscience. Swami would say this with reference to some of the dreams that we would have. Swami would say that, you know, you have dreams, and sometimes Swami would give some instructions in your dreams, or sometimes some others would come and tell you that Swami told me to tell you to do this, right? In such scenarios, Swami would say that ask yourself if the instruction that you got in your dream or from this person is consistent with your experience of who Swami is. Will Swami give you such an instruction? And that reflection each one of us have to do with regards to any influence that we have on our thinking, right? This I'm telling about when instructions come in a dream or from others. But with regards to our thinking process itself, this has to be done. For instance, now you're listening to this program. Now you're listening to me. You have to take time out to reflect and see if what you hear from me in this program, or for that matter, any of us on radio, you have to reflect and see whether it is consistent with Swami's message as you understand it. It's not merely knowledge of Swami. That's why I said your knowledge of Swami accessed through your conscience. I don't think any of us can claim absolute knowledge of Swami and his message. I think we are a long way off before we get there. But at the point we are, from our reading of Swami, from our experience of Swami, and through our intuitive understanding of what Swami would expect us to do, we have to every now and then filter out what we are listening, right? So even when you listen to this program or any of our programs on Radio Sai, every now and then you have to reflect within and ask yourself if this is consistent with Swami's message. If it is not, you have to reject it. Just because it is being said on Radio Sai, just because it's a Swami student who's speaking, or just because it's a long-time devotee, it need not necessarily be right, right? So that is why that recalibration process is very, very important. And Swami would say this on many occasions when people would go up to Swami and said, Swami, I heard this from so-and-so. You know, this long-time devotee said that Swami had told this. Swami would have only one reply to that. Swami would say, what does your experience say, right? So as you said, the case of the friends that you were mentioning. Yes, we cannot run away from the friends that we have. We are not meant to be running away from people, right? At some point, when we are in the presence of people who are with different ideas, we accept them as they are, but we are able to stand up for what we believe in. is when our beliefs are really strong, like the quote I started with today, right? It's not just about having belief systems, but sticking to those belief systems, even when probably, you know, it may be sometimes unpopular, or it may not be the thing which everybody else appreciates and understands. But if you believe in it, you have to stand by it, right? And that will happen only when we are in a crowd which is very diverse, only when we are moving with people who have different belief systems, but still we can hold on to it, right? So this process is very, very important, that every now and then we have to take a step back and review our understanding. As you rightly said, when we spend time in the company of others, you know, we tend to start thinking like them. We see that all the time happening to us. So every now and then we have to take a step back and, you know, recalibrate our thinking with reference to something more absolute. And in our case, it's Swami and Swami's words, right? That's why prayer, the time that we spend in solitude, the time that we spend in mananam or contemplation on what we hear is very, very important. So it's important for us to, in whatever way we can, if you know, either reading Swami's words or listening to Swami's discourses, or somebody whom you really trust in, somebody, I mean, who has over a period of time, probably stood the test of time, and you're able to say that, you know, this person, I know that whatever he or she is saying is in accordance to Swami's message, listening to from that person, or, you know, taking some time out and probably having a small chat with that person. This recalibration is very, very important, right? It's not wrong that we have to keep the company of those people. Yes, we cannot, always choose perfect company. As I said, sometimes we are duty bound to work with people who are not as perfect as we would want. The only perfect company that we can think of is the company of the Swami within, right? That's the only company that we can have. That is why all of these things, having a set time for prayer, having some time for yourself where you reflect within, that contemplation, that mananam, which is so very important. And as much as possible, going back to Swami's message and seeing that, you know, this is how I'm thinking because of the influence of the people around. And is it in line with what Swami says, right? Because as I started off with that quote, when we say that I have faith in Swami, it is an acknowledgement. When you say that I believe Swami is God, I believe Swami is my master, it is an acknowledgement that what Swami says is more valuable and more, absolute than the words of anybody else, right? That is what it is. That is the acknowledgement that we make when we say that this is what I believe in, right? So every now and then we have to look at our thoughts and say that, is it inconsistency with what Swami says? Is it in alignment with what Swami says? If it is not, we discard it. We still respect the person that we move with, right? Because end of the day, we all are different and we will be different till the end of time. There's no escape from that. So we respect and accept people as they are, but we believe in our systems, we believe in our mind what is consistent with Swami's words, because we have acknowledged that Swami is wiser than the rest of the world put together, right? So it's very important to take time out and do this recalibration as many times as possible. I hope that answered the question, and I hope that was what was being looked for in the process of that question. I still have another question from this listener. Probably that will be for a later day, maybe next week or the week after that. If you have any further clarifications on what I've said, feel free to write to me, as always, at prem@radiosai.org. With that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap this week's program on Radio Sai Answering Booth. If you have a question on practical spirituality, feel free to write to me. I invite questions to my personal mail ID. That's prem@radiosai.org, prem@radiosai.org. It's my personal mail ID, so the mails that you send to that are confidential. If you wish to be anonymous, like the listener who sent us questions this week, do let me know. I will not mention your name. If you have If you can send your question in your own voice, like the listener today, that would be perfect. It's always interesting to have a different voice. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, do I make up questions? No, I don't make up questions, because the questions that come are so profound, I don't have a need to make up questions. And it always adds a little bit of authenticity when it's in your own voice. And it's always wonderful to have another fresh voice on the program. Before I leave, I'm going to leave you with one of my favorite songs. I'm sure you'll enjoy it too. On the other side of the song, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and Sai Prakash for the last segment of today's live broadcast, the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
Gotcha.